Good evening. Welcome to Ragtime America. I'm Jack Rummel. I'm with you for an hour of recorded music and talking tonight because we are presenting the first of a two-part interview with Max Morath. I'm pleased to say that Max Morath was inducted into the Colorado Music Hall of Fame on April 16th, and I was proud to be in the audience and watch that happen. There were several notable people who were inducted at that time: Glenn Miller, Paul Whiteman, early singer Billy Murray, Elizabeth Spencer, Lanny Garrett, and of course Max himself. And Max was gracious enough to set aside some time and granted an interview. We spent about 45 minutes talking, and it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. So I'm going to present the first half of that interview tonight and intersperse it with some of Max's music, either music that he himself has written or music that he was known to have presented. And then we'll have the second half of this coming up next week. So I guess without further ado, we'll just go to our interview with Max Morath. We're speaking this evening with Max Morath, who is in town because he's being inducted into the Colorado Music Hall of Fame. Welcome to our microphone.
Thank you very much, Jack.
We're delighted to have you here. You being a Colorado native, I guess.
I was born and raised in Colorado Springs, went to Colorado College, and yeah, I still claim myself as one of those rarities, a Colorado native.
Yeah, and at the time, Colorado was sort of out in the hicks somewhere.
Well, you know, the thing about Colorado Springs that people have forgotten, because when I grew up, it was 30,000 people, and it was pretty much the home of a lot of retired wealth.
Oh.
And the rest of us worked for them.
I see, okay.
And there was actually, and I'm sure there may be some of your listeners that will remember this, there was actually a strong element in Colorado Springs that resisted the advent of industry or military.
Oh, really?
They wanted to make it their little town. And, you know, many of the first settlers were British.
Oh.
And in those days, one of the nicknames of Colorado Springs was Little London.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
I don't speak in a British accent, though.
Not unless you force yourself. What was your early exposure to music of any kind?
Well, my mother was a very good pianist, and she was classically trained, but also played the pop stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And she played ragtime.
Oh, okay.
And she had a good two-handed command of the instrument. As a matter of fact, she studied at Iowa State. She grew up in Ottumwa, Iowa.
Okay.
One of eight kids on a farm, you know. But she took kid piano lessons, and she was a crackerjack sight reader and got interested in ragtime because, after all, she was born in 1897. Her big brother, an attorney and one of those Renaissance man guys who could play anything by ear but could not read music.
Ah.
So he'd buy the rags, and now we're talking 1906, 1907. Okay. This is the prime time, right?
It is.
And they're a few miles from St. Louis, and Uncle Dick would bring home the new sheet music, which he couldn't read. And he'd sit little Gladys down to the piano, and she's 12 years old and nails it. And then he sits down and plays it improvisationally.
Oh.
And you know, one of my memories, they still had the farm when we went back there. I was 9 years old, and we went to visit the relatives on the farm. And I watched my Uncle Dick take a raw egg, drop it into an empty glass, and fill the glass up with Old Crow. Drink it in one gulp and sit down and play the piano like God.
Oh, wow.
And he played the rags sweetly.
Mm.
Never in tempo. Always played them as music and melody, and I'll never forget it. And I've never heard him, you know, never heard him again.
Well, that must have been an experience.
Well, I think it's got to have been a subconscious influence on me.
Okay.
And then my mother had a piano bench full of sheet music.
Okay.
When she came to Colorado from Iowa.
Max Morath at the piano with a piece from 1975 that he composed called Echoes of the Rosebud. That, of course, refers to the famous Rosebud Cafe in St. Louis, certainly the watering hole for most of the ragtime pianists that were working in the area at the turn of the century. And so you heard some themes there from three or four well-known rags, and then a little bit of Max's own composition himself, all mixed together. A very nice opening to this interview, and a tip of the hat to his uncle, who drank Old Crow and played sweetly, and also to his mother, who came out here with a piano bench full of sheet music. Let's move on to the interview with Max Morath.
The first job she got was playing for the silent movies at the old Princess Theater in Colorado Springs.
Okay.
And she was playing the piano around the house, and fortunately we had a good big old 54-inch upright in the parlor.
Now, did you, when you graduated from Colorado College, were you intent on a career in music at that point?
No, I was intent on a career in this business.
Oh.
My first job was as a radio announcer. I was 17 years old, and I got a job as an announcer at KVOR, which in that, KVOR, the voice of the Rockies in Colorado Springs. And it was the only station in town, and it was a sister station at that time of KLZ in Denver.
Okay.
And it was a full-fledged 1,000-watt CBS station. And I got a job there. And I had just started college, and I was determined on a career in broadcasting. And did for a long time.
Okay.
Pretty much earned my living either in radio and or television and or doing commercials and so forth. Always playing the piano, by the way. Gigs here and gigs there.
Did you get instructions from people other than your music, your mother, on piano?
Well, Jack, you know, I never really studied music. I took some kid piano lessons. When I was a junior in high school, I was in a band, a pretty awful band, but there were 12 of us, and I was trying to write arrangements and didn't know how. So I, again, my mother stepped in and said, well, I'll pay $2 a lesson, and there was a wonderful musicologist at Colorado College, and I took theory and harmony from him on the college level when I was a junior in high school, and I learned how to arrange.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that was not playing. Mm. It was just writing, which stood me in good stead all my life.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Another piece by Max Barath from 1975. This is the New Black Eagle Buck, featuring Max along with a jazz band. And an example of how Max arranges a piece. He actually wrote that as a commission for the New Black Eagle Jazz Band back in Boston. And as it turned out, it was a little bit difficult for them, and so they never did record it. But Max has recorded it and done a darn fine job there, and a nice arrangement, too. Okay, all right. On now with more of the interview with Max Barath. Now, you did play in Cripple Creek.
Oh, yeah. Started in Cripple Creek, Colorado, the summer of 1950. And I had been working, you know, I grew up with Cripple Creek part of my life, after all. What brought my father's side of the family to Colorado was Cripple Creek gold.
Oh. Okay.
None of them ever hit it. But the Maraths stayed around there. And, of course, by the time I was a kid, Cripple Creek was not a ghost town, but not far from it. But we'd hike up there and go up there and hang out and walk the old railroad beds and stuff. And then my first job up there was, I was still in college, and I got a job playing weekends at a place called Hammer's Tavern. And it was about as tough as its title sounds. There were a bunch of pretty tough, they were still mining going on. Four or five mines were still up there. There was a little population there. And I had a trio. I had a friend that played a little bit of drums, and there was a miner there. I'll never forget him. I think he was a full-blooded Cheyenne or Ute.
Oh.
And he was his name was Joe Bluejacket.
Mm.
Now, this is 1947-6. He played amplified guitar.
Oh, my.
At that time, you know, it had just come along. And this guy played fabulous jazz, and he was a miner.
Hmm.
So we had this great trio, and it lasted until one night toward the end of the summer. There was about a 350-pound Welch hard rock miner fell off the bar stool and demolished the drum.
Oh.
And we were, the sheriff came, you know. It was my last gig until we went up the street to the Imperial Hotel, where the couple that had just bought it after the war inaugurated Melodrama.
Okay.
And I was their first musical director, and worked with a wonderful director in Colorado Springs, Orvis Grout.
Okay.
And he was a wonderful director that directed the Colorado Springs Civic Theater. Anyway, I ended up working Cripple Creek 6 or 7 seasons during the 50s. And my job was to do the music of the show and play the themes of the characters as one did with Melodrama, and then play for the drunks at the intermissions.
Okay.
Yeah. That's one of the jobs of any piano player.
Thank you.
That was Aaron Robinson at the piano, who has recorded a wonderful album of the complete piano works of Max Morath. And it's called The Gold Bar Rag that Max wrote in copyrighted in 1964. I think it was written a long time earlier than that, maybe even when he was still working in Cripple Creek. Okay, on now with another segment of our Max Morath interview. Well, your interest in broadcast then, and plus this experience of playing ragtime ultimately led you into some television, did it not?
Yes, and one of the things that I have emphasized here in this visit to the induction, gratifyingly, of the Hall of Fame, is that a turning point in my own life or career was also a turning point in the development of public broadcasting in Denver at Channel 6.
I believe that.
And the way that came about, and it's a bit of a long story, but I think it's worth noting that I did 26 half hours on videotape, which were distributed all over the country in the early 60s. Part of the reason for their success was that they were one of the first series that made the transition from educational radio, with quotes. In other words, educational radio and television in those days was one camera, a guy standing in front of a gray drape doing education.
Yeah, okay.
And that was cool. The home office was still in Ann Arbor, Michigan. They decided they wanted to find at least some basic entertainment elements,
mm-hmm.
music, continuity, fun. And right at that time, I was working with a stage manager who had become a producer at Channel 6. And I'll have to remind you that in Channel 6, we're talking 1959.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This was one of the few television stations in the so-called public area in which this was a high-level, professionally run, three-camera operation with everything.
Oh, great.
Lights, sound, top talent in the artistic and set design area. They were just a beautiful place to do real television. And I'd been working. I was the production manager of the first television station in Colorado Springs.
Okay.
6 years before that, so I knew how to get around the camera. But the key that happened, and I know that this probably isn't what people want to hear, but the reason that first series, the Ragtime Era, was successful was, yeah, okay, it was fun, and it was a breakthrough in content, but it was the first series that went national on reel-to-reel black and white videotape.
My goodness.
And one of the things, and I've done this spiel, and I think I did it for Channel 6 several times in one of their look-back programs. Up until that time, and some of your listeners may remember, television from New York, if you got the Ed Sullivan Show, you got it on 16-millimeter kinescope film, grainy, terrible, terrible quality. And then, almost like overnight, the Ford Foundation, through Ampex, developed these huge reel-to-reel videotapes.
Okay.
And one never forgets the first time you see videotape, instant playback. We all got used, you know, here, audio tape. You know, and the first time you heard yourself played back on a rewind, you thought, wow, this is something new. This was television at its best. And, I mean, technically now, I'm not talking about content. Technically, these were beautiful pictures. And here's another thing, and I'll never forget this man's name. These things were difficult to operate. They were touchy. You had 2-inch tape traveling at 30 inches a second over rotating heads.
Oh, my.
And they were hard to manage. Our chief engineer, the late Scotty Cullen, and I hope some of his relatives would be listening. Scotty Cullen was the chief engineer at Channel 6, and he could run those things like he'd run them all his life. Get beautiful pictures with high contrast, clear content, no rollovers, no interference. And what turned out was that all these other little stations, and there were 60 of them, They couldn't run them. They didn't have an engineer.
Okay.
So Scotty is on all the airplanes flying to every city in the country, teaching them how to run an Ampex videotape and carrying a copy of Max Morath's show to air on their air.
All right.
So here's the thing. I have always felt, and I gave some lectures about this over the years, if you want to see what happened with the entertainment business, with music, with drama, go to technology.
Oh, okay.
That's what changed our lives,
well,
and still does.
And still does.
By the minute.
Yeah.
And I used to do a lecture that began with these lines. If it weren't for the vacuum tube, Bing Crosby would be practicing law in Spokane. If it weren't for semiconductors and multi-track videotape or audio tape, Rick Jagger would be teaching economics at Trinity College.
My goodness.
That was his major, you know. And if it weren't for talking film, Mary Pickford might not have become an alcoholic.
Oh.
Because, you know, her voice was terrible.
Yeah.
And she was the biggest star in the business. But she couldn't do talkies.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So there's three examples of three stars whose life was changed by technology.
All right. Well, let's pick a couple of songs that Max sang on the shows that he made famous, perhaps the one that started it all off on television, or maybe the traveling shows that went around the country. So here are a couple of songs. We'll play them back to back. Well, I'll identify the titles afterwards. I think many listeners will recognize them right away.
Trouble than I can stand. Ever since ragtime has struck the land, never saw the like in all of my days. Everybody's got the ragtime craze. Stood it just as long as I could. At last I got it, and I got it good. First I didn't want any in mine, but now I'm right in line. I got a ragtime dog and a ragtime cat, a ragtime piano in my ragtime flat. I got ragtime clothes from hat to shoes. I read a paper called the Ragtime News. I got ragtime habits and I talk that way. I sleep in ragtime and rag all day. Got ragtime troubles with my ragtime wife. I'm certainly living a ragtime life. I got a ragtime dog and a ragtime cat, a ragtime piano in my ragtime flat. I'm wearing ragtime clothes from hat to shoes. I read a paper called the Ragtime News. I got ragtime habits, I talk that way. I sleep in ragtime and rag all day. I got ragtime troubles with my ragtime wife. I'm certainly living what you might call a ragtime life.
Let me tell you this. This is a true story. It's about Mrs. Oliver H.P. Belmont of New York City and Newport, one of the big wheels in this Votes for Women thing. One day, a young girl who had just started to work for suffrage, depressed, discouraged, in tears, she went to Mrs. Belmont for encouragement. And Mrs. Oliver H.P. Belmont, grand old lady, said to her, "Brace up, my dear, and pray to God. She will protect you." In those days, for the first time in the history of Western civilization, young girls were leaving the villages and the farms and going to the big cities alone. And you know, they said in those days there was only one reason why a young girl would leave her village or farm and go to the city alone. Sin. If not in her past, then definitely in her future. But as the song said, heaven would protect the working girl. They used to believe that, I guess. Not anymore. There's history in a nutshell for you, you see. From heaven to the AF of L in 50 years. There's the song. A village maid was leaving home with tears, her eyes were wet. Her mother dear was standing near the spot. She said to her, "Neuralgia dear, I hope you won't forget that I'm the only mother you have got. The city is a wicked place, as anyone can see, and cruel dangers round your path may whirl, your path may whirl. So every week, be sure to send your wages back to me, 'cause heaven will protect the working girl. You are going far away, so remember what I say. When you are in the city's giddy whirl, from temptations, crimes, and follies, villains, hansom cabs, and trolleys, heaven will protect the working girl." Her dear old mother's words were true, for soon the poor girl met a man who on her ruin was intent. He treated her respectful, as those villains always do, and she supposed he was a perfect gent. But she found different when one night she went with him to dine into a table d'hôte so bright and gay. Then he said to her, "After this, we'll have a demi-tasse." Then to him these brave words the girl did say: "Stand back, villain, go your way. Here I will no longer stay. Although you were a marquis or an earl, you may tempt the upper classes with your villainous demi-tasses. Heaven will protect the working girl."
Two songs that Max often sang. I'm certainly living a ragtime life, and heaven will protect the working girl. Let's get back now to our interview. Well, what came next? Was it recordings, or was it that you decided to take a show on the road?
Both. All of the above.
Okay.
You know, I've intersected a lot of wonderful young performers in my life, and there's no answer or there's no key. And the thing I find myself saying is just take the next job.
Mm.
If you actually are in any area of the entertainment / music business and can pay your bills with it, stay with it, but take the next job, the next turn in the road. It may be a recording contract. It may be an agent that you've never heard of. It may be something that doesn't work out, but don't quit.
Okay.
That's about it.
So you've been doing your show and your recordings, dare I ask, for how many years?
I retired. Well, I didn't really retire. 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
I started when I was 17, and I played my last professional job in New York in 2006.
Okay.
And I didn't really retire, Jack. I was fortunate enough over the years to follow this pattern. I would do an off-Broadway production, a new script, a new show with a new title. And I would hope to get good reviews. And if and when I did, then the phone would ring and I'd be with an agency that would book me for the next 4 years around the country. If you play, you get good reviews in New York, you can play Des Moines, you know. And that's how it works.
Even Colorado Springs.
Even Colorado Springs, which I did many times. And Denver. And by the way, I spent a lot of years in Denver working, when I was living in Denver, working conventions and saloons and piano bars and whatever came along, every job. And then again in 2004, I decided to repeat the same pattern because my bookings were lagging. So I did another show at the York Theater in New York, and it went very well, and we did good business, and we got good reviews, but my phone quit ringing. Figuratively. That is, unless you can, if you're doing the concert field, traveling to various theaters, you got to have a tour. You can't take a one-nighter in Toledo, Ohio on March 31st and then figure out how you're going to build around it.
Yeah.
You've got to have a tour. And there are certain agencies, only a handful of them, that can do that for you. And I have to say, after that show, and I've had good success, and I thought, well, here I go. I'll go back to Columbia Artists or something. Didn't happen. And then, just between you and me, I also saw a little videotape of one of the nights of that show, and I was 80. And I looked at that videotape and I said, who's that old man walking across the stage?
Oh, Max, no, no, no.
Everything in nature in the course of time changes into something else. You can wager nothing ever stays the same. Oceans freeze and ice cream melts. Butterflies were caterpillars first, and winter is summer, conveniently reversed. Ashes turn to ashes, and dust into dust. Kids turn into grown-ups, and iron into rust. And in this world of germination and decay, carbohydrates are demolished every day. Fermentation, without the slightest bit of provocation, will take your sugar, grain, or vegetation, and in no time at all, turn it into residue and alcohol. High taxation has never kept the boozing population from claiming benefits from fermentation, though it fuzzes the tongue, petrifies the liver, and seduces the young. This libation should not be used except in moderation, or a handy form of soothing medication, a dainty preparation with a peppermint base will please a pious lady who abhors the taste. Lamentation, and no amount of legal regulation can stop this chemical disintegration. So we might just as well call it things like Applejack or Muscatel, and let it take us to heaven or down to hell.
Ruination awaits apostles of this lubrication.
In search of revelation, we come to locked up in a cell, smelling of fermentation.
Oh, from one of Max's shows, a song that Max actually wrote called Fermentation, dates from 1980. He sang it there with Gene Jones, the two of them, part of the stage performance. Okay, on with more of our Max Morath interview. Now, much of your recording career was with Vanguard. Did you have sort of a special arrangement with them? Or?
One of the luckiest breaks in my life was to go with those brothers, Maynard and Seymour Solomon. They were a couple of bright young New York guys. Seymour Solomon was a fine musician, played the violin. Maynard Solomon was the businessman.
Okay.
The two of them started Vanguard way back when they were just out of college, City College, of course, Jewish guys, that's where you went. And they were very successful, and they cut across all disciplines. They had classical, they had Joan Baez.
Yes, you know, I know.
And they had Buffy St. Marie.
Yes.
They had Clark Terry in the jazz world. And I had done some albums. I did a couple albums for Epic, which was run by Columbia. And they were okay. But working with Vanguard, and I went with them in 1970 or so. I did 12 albums with them, and they let me do pretty much what I wanted to do, which was either solo piano or vocals or tape the show or record the show, I mean. And then the other lucky break, because they were honest. I mean, if you had royalties coming, they came and the check cleared. And I got to tell you, the ripoffs in the recording business, especially with the young performers, especially with the black performers, are disgusting. There's so many ways to hide money in the record business, and most of them do it. Vanguard Records wouldn't even think of it. They wouldn't know how. And when they were sold in 1986, guess who bought them? Lawrence Welk.
Okay.
The other honest man.
Okay, very
good. In the recording business. And they kept the label Vanguard all those years. They kept me in print. They turned them over to CDs when those came along. And by the way, just for your listeners' information, just 6 months ago, Vanguard was finally sold out from under the Welk umbrella to Concord. So Vanguard is now a Concord label.
Okay.
And I don't know what disposition they will make of my CDs, but Lawrence Welk kept those CDs, most of them, in print for 25 years.
That's quite a record.
Well, it's not done in the entertainment
business. No, it's not. It certainly is not. from one of those fine Vanguard records. This one dated 1973, called Max Morath Plays the World of Scott Joplin. We heard one of Max's own compositions, copyrighted in 1964, called One for Amelia. And that was written for the widow of the great ragtime composer Joseph Lamb shortly after he died. One for Amelia, as played by Max Morath. Let's close out now the first half of our interview with Max Morath. Well, of all the recordings that you made, do you have a favorite?
Yes, I do, Jack. My favorite is not a piano ragtime favorite, although there's plenty of piano on it. I became, for years, early on, even when I was still in high school, fascinated by the careers of many of the young black entertainers, not only the pianists, but the vaudevillians and the theatrical people, principally Burt Williams.
Yes.
And Burt Williams was a star, and his career was typical of the crazy world in which a black performer had to work in those years. But he had great material, and he was funny, and he finally became a major star with the Ziegfeld Follies, and died unexpectedly in 1921, or I think he'd have been as well known as Louis Armstrong, or, you know, he died. And I used to listen to his recordings, because he made a lot of recordings for Columbia Records, and he talked his songs.
Ah, okay.
But back of the talking, I'd hear the music, and there were some really fine composers, mostly out of that same black community in New York, that were writing the music for the songs that he talked. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm going to sing those songs. Jonah Man.
Yes. That was the name of the album, wasn't it?
Yeah, right, yeah. Jonah Man. And he did his great song, Nobody.
Mm-hmm.
And the subtext, and I guess you and your listeners would understand, the subtext of Williams' work was comedic, and underneath it, a sad and bitter quality. And he performed, of course, to both white and black audiences. And I'm not sure what they thought. But I realized that this was a body of work that I wanted to do and I thought had a market. And the album did okay. It's still in print, by the way, I must say.
Great.
So that's great.
Yeah.
Is full of clouds and rain, and I am filled with naught but pain. Who soothes my thumping, bumping brain? Nobody. When I try hard and scheme and plan, look my best, the best I can. Who says, look at that handsome man? Nobody. Now I never done nothing to know. And I never got nothing from nobody, no time. And until I get something from somebody, sometime, I don't intend to do nothing for nobody. Time.
snow and sleet and me with hunger and cold feet. Who says, come on in here, get yourself a bite to eat? Nobody. And when all day long things go amiss and I rush home to find me some bliss, who is it greets me at the door with a glowing kiss? Nobody. Nobody. Nobody.
Bert Williams' favorite, or famous tune, Nobody, sung by Max Marath from his favorite LP album. Well, we've got time to squeeze at least one and maybe two more in, so here's one of the better-known songs that Max likes to sing.
I've been looking through the dictionary for a word that is running through my mind. Though I love the name of brother, I am searching for another. Though I must admit, that word I cannot find. Can it be that all its glories are forgotten and buried with the language of the Greek? If it is, it'll ever linger in my memory as the first word that I heard my daddy speak. Saloon, saloon. Saloon. It runs through my brain like a tune. I don't like cafes and I hate cabarets, but mention saloon and my cares fade away. It brings back a fond recollection of a little old low-ceilinged room with a bar and a rail and a dime and a pail. Saloon, saloon, saloon.
have to get off the air here fairly soon. We've been interviewing Max Morath tonight. We'll do the second half of this interview next Thursday night, so I hope you can tune in. It's been a lot of fun. This is Jack Rummel. Thanks for joining us. And we'll let Max take us out with one of his best-known numbers. This is Polyragmic that you're listening to. Time is 9 o'clock. You're listening to KGNU Boulder, Denver, 88.5 FM, 1390 AM, and on the World Wide Web at kgnu.org. Stay tuned for Swing Shift.
Thanks as always, Jack. What a delight to follow a program like that. This is Dave Gloss with Swing Shift this evening. And tonight, with the good weather, we're headed out by the sea. So stay tuned for some really wonderful sounds. We're going to start tonight's broadcast with the legendary Jackie Gleason and his orchestra and a reprise of a hit from the 20s. We'll be right back.
Mm-hmm.